There's an ancient legend about an island named Atlantis. It was supposed to have been located somewhere in the Atlantic west of Gibraltar, and Plato said that it had sunk into the sea. Now, if such a thing did happen, it would be extremely unusual. We don't know of anything ever sinking into the sea like that, not an island, not a continent. It's been said for years that California is about to fall off into the sea. And people say that there'll be a big enough earthquake to split that, and Arizona will have beachfront property, and California just going to be gone, sunk into the ocean. Well, would be would be pretty radical if that fault line split deep enough to get water on this side of California. But even more unbelievable if it sank into the ocean. Stuff like that just doesn't happen. And so it brings a question to mind. What keeps us from sinking? Why don't we sink into the ocean? I mean, why don't the land masses over time just settle down into the water that there's so much of until everything is just gone? Even the continents are just big islands surrounded by much more water than there is land. And the water doesn't undermine them. It doesn't seep in and weaken the continents until they just become watery, muddy messes. And they don't sink. Well, this miracle of dry land in the midst of a very wet planet is just one of the amazing acts carried out by God on the third day of creation. If you've got your Bible, turn to Genesis 1 and verse 9. Today we'll study verses 9 through 13, which is the account of day 3. Genesis 1, 9 through 13. Verse 9 says, "Then God said, 'Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear.' And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, 'Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees on the earth bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them.' And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with the seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. There was morning and there was evening, a third day." Now, the first thing mentioned here is dry land. It's far more astonishing than we probably ever consider or think about. Bogs and swamps and quicksand and quagmires are incredibly rare in the world. And even where they are there, most of what's around them is still dry land. For the most part, the dry land is dry. The rivers stay in their places, and even when they flood, the waters recede, the rivers go back to their places, and the land becomes dry pretty quickly. And it never becomes just a muddy, watery mess. Rain falls on the earth and makes it muddy, but it never washes the earth into the sea, not in any significant amount. The land always dries out. The land never sinks. It never blends into the ocean until it's all just a big, muddy mess. But there's so much water, it could do that if something weren't keeping it from that. God simply spoke, and dry land appeared out of this watery, chaotic mess with all the elements in it. It could have been a bubbling, muddy, slimy mess with land and water mixed together in this muddy cauldron of chaos. It could have been land under the sea, and God changed the elevation. However he did it, God spoke, and it was so. He makes the separation on the third day. He sets the limits and he names the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he names seas. It did not happen by chance. It can't happen by chance because order doesn't come from chaos. God did this by his wisdom. In Proverbs 8:29, it's talking about wisdom, and it says, wisdom was there, quote, when he set for the sea its boundary so that the water should not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth. It's God's power that gives you firm ground to stand on and keeps the waters within their boundaries. It's God's work that gave us the foundations that keep the water from undermining the earth, the dry land, so that we don't sink into the sea and it doesn't just blend into a big muddy mess. God did this on the third day. Now, up to this point in the creation account, God's working has been entirely with material things. He's created heaven and earth out of nothing, something that is staggering, but material. He brought forth the matter that makes up the earth, all of the elements. He brought forth the water. He created the minerals and all the other stuff of the planet. Then he created light, which also is amazing beyond our ability to comprehend fully. But it's still in the material realm. Even though we can't define everything about light, whether it's a wave or a particle or what it is, we still know it's material. Then God created the atmosphere, breathable air, air that doesn't burn off or grow stale or wear out, air that has never drifted off into space, air that has never been poisoned by natural disaster like volcanoes spewing out all sorts of toxic chemicals into the atmosphere, never been harmed in any significant way by anything people have done through pollution, never been affected in any significant way by anything that came in from space. I mean, it's still here. We're still breathing it, and it's been here. God created it. And then he creates the land. He separates the dry land from the sea, and it stays separate because God set the boundaries. Now, creation up to this point has been staggering in its complexity. Already, we've seen all sorts of things that people just can't do. We can't even imitate this on a small scale using the stuff God made. We can't even take his stuff and do the same stuff with it. It's already staggering. It's already far beyond anything that any rational person should ever consider just happened. Doesn't make sense. But in verses 11 and 12, we get something even more incredible than all of that. Look again at those two verses. Then God said, still on third day, then God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit after their kind with the seed in them. And it was so, and the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. This is the first time in the unfolding of God's creation for us in his revelation that life is introduced. Biological life. Forms of life capable of growth and reproduction. And however complex it is to think that God could bring matter out of nothing, or that God could create something as complex as light that we don't understand, this step in creation pales everything else. Nobody can fathom how life can come from non-life. Nobody can say how life can be made. Nobody understands this. No evolutionist has ever put forth a plausible explanation for the presence of life. They believe that it rained on the rocks for millions and millions of years, and somehow by a miraculous quirk of chance, the building blocks of life came together in this primordial soup that resulted from millions of years of rain on the rocks, and there was life. No one has ever been able to simulate this. Nobody's ever been able to take these building blocks of life that they call it and put them together and have life happen. You know what we get when we do this? You get rearranged dead building blocks. That's how much we can do. We can take these dead building blocks of life, put them together, and have dead building blocks of life that are put together. We just can't make it be alive. No one has ever been able to do that part. Now, our scientists can do some pretty amazing things. I mean, you can deal with stuff way down on a subcellular level. You can map genetic code now. You can deal with things in detail that not very many years ago people didn't even know existed. They didn't even know it was there. Now you can identify it. You can evaluate the complex chemical makeup of this thing on the subcellular level. You can map it out. You can do all sorts of things. Add chemicals, take out chemicals, add electricity. You can try everything. But even borrowing the stuff of life that God has put here, and even beginning with what God has already put in place, and even using God's examples to copy from. You know, you got the book right here. You got all these examples of life right here. Copy that one, make it happen. I mean, that's a pretty good shortcut, isn't it? Here's all the material, and here's a working model. Go, make it happen. Even with that, nobody can make this happen. This thing that was supposed to have happened by chance cannot be made to happen by chance or by force of will or by human intellect. Not so far, anyway. Nobody can seem to add that most important intangible that makes it alive. People have called it the spark of life. That's the part we can't add. We can't stop it from going away, and we can't put it in. We don't know what it is. Now, by all accounts, plant life is simple in comparison to our lives or to other animal life. Many plants are single-cell organisms that are called simple. We studied about Chlamydomonas when I was in college. One cell, plant, capable of photosynthesis. Little bitty thing, got to have a microscope to see it. Simple. But not even, well, even these little bitty, single cell, simple organisms are too complicated for us to copy. Having the blueprint and having all the materials provided for us, we can't make it happen. All the cumulative knowledge of all the centuries remains inadequate to cause that spark of life to happen, or even to define what it is, or keep it from going away when it's time for something to die. We have no control over that. Not even with the shortcuts that are here, because all of the things that God put here. Yet on the third day of creation, Almighty God spoke, and life became life all over this planet. He said, "Let it be," and it was so. This was no more difficult for God than any other part of creation that boggles our minds and that we cannot imitate. None of it was hard. God just said it, and it was so. With all the ease possible, God just willed it, and it happened. It's no more difficult for him than anything. Nothing's hard for God. Now, this first form of life that God made is plant life. And I want to note some specific features of plant life that are mentioned in this text, verses 11 and 12, a couple of issues that come up here. And the thing that is emphasized in this text is the ability of these new creations to reproduce themselves. It says there is seed, and it says in each of those two verses that there's fruit with the seed in it, or the seed with it. So this is life that reproduces itself. Again, this is something that we can't really quite define how it works. We don't completely understand what happens even as we observe it, and even though we've put names on it all. We know that you can put a seed in the dirt. Most of the time, it'll germinate and grow. Germinate is when it gets that spark of life that we can't define. We got a word for it. We just don't know why it happens or how it happens. And it produces exactly the same kind of plant as the plant it came from. We don't know what makes one seed germinate and another seed fail to germinate. One will germinate and grow. Another seed will rot in the ground. We don't know why. Nobody can look at the dead seeds and say, this one's going to grow and this one's going to rot. But most of them grow and some of them rot. And you can't tell any difference between them with any technique we've come up with yet to measure. It's that spark of life that we can't define or duplicate. But most of them grow given the right conditions. Some of them don't. Some of them will lie dormant in the ground while their neighbors grow. And they'll wait and grow next year. How does it know to do that? Some of them might lie there 2 or 3 years and then grow. But if the seed does not die first, none of them ever grow. If the seed doesn't die on the plant, shrivel up, it will not germinate ever. If you've got flowers and you want to save the seeds and you hurry this along and you go out and pull it off while the flower is still vibrant looking, none of them will grow. Let it die. Let the blossoms all look pitiful and dead and go out there and pull these old dried up things off, put them in the ground, they'll grow. Out of dirt, by the way. Dirt. Now think of the variety that comes up out of the dirt. Watermelons and wheat. Apples and broccoli. Homegrown tomatoes, pecans, and stuff that you don't know what to call. Thousands of seeds and fruit-bearing plants, also different from one another, all growing up out of dirt. And every seed that grows produces the plant, a plant that is just like the plant it came from. There's never any confusion in these seeds. They all make the same thing they were from. So completely different from each other, growing in different kinds of soil than the parent plant, different places. You can take it to a different climate. It will still grow the same kind of plant if it'll grow at all. Every seed will produce the same plant as the plant from which it came. Now, this is true because of what God said in verse 11. Part of God's command includes these words, after their kind. This is how it is. Now, the evolutionist believes that things produce something other than their kind. It's fundamental to that faith. Everything has to grow something other than what it is in order for evolution to work. Either through gradual change over many, many years or through sudden genetic mutation, you have to have seeds and animals producing something other than what they are. And at some point, you even have to have seeds producing animals for this to work. Plant a cabbage, get a hamster. I don't know. It's illegal not to teach it in our country now. Been affirmed this week on Thursday in Cobb County. It is against the law now even to question it. Plant a cabbage, get a hamster. However, the evolutionist says it happens, whether quickly or over long spans of time, he still has to say something comes from something different. Something does not come after its kind, but of another kind. Now, let's not confuse that idea that you can plant a cabbage and get a hamster over millions and millions of years. That makes it make sense, yeah. Let's not confuse that with selecting characteristics in plants or animals, which we would call breeding. You can practice selective breeding. Dogs are a real good example. You pick a characteristic that you want. You like long ears? You think all dogs ought to have long ears, and I'm going to at least do my part to see that this happens. Then you pick a couple of dogs with long ears, and they mate to each other, and the dogs are likely to have long ears. The puppies are likely to have long ears. And over many, many generations, you can produce a new breed of dog that has very long ears. You pick the characteristics you want. You put dogs together that have those characteristics. If some dog is born that doesn't have the ones you want, you don't keep those in the loop anymore. You bring in some more that have those characteristics that you want. And after many generations, you can make certain characteristics dominant. Now, what this means is that one guy can go to the pet store now and buy a golden retriever, and another guy can go to the pet store and buy a dachshund. The secret is they both get dogs. And this is the thing that the evolutionist just isn't dealing with. It's still a dog. It's very different from the other dog, but they're both dogs. You didn't get a new species. You got a funny-looking dog. No one has ever demonstrated that God's command in Genesis 1:11, which here relates to plants, can ever be violated. Things do not reproduce another kind. They reproduce after their own kind. And even though a dachshund looks very different from a golden retriever, looks very different from a bull mastiff, they're still dogs. That's the same kind. You can't violate this. No one has ever demonstrated any evidence that it could be different from this, and they won't because God said it would be this way, and it was so. Now, these plants mentioned in these two verses, 11 and 12, produce plants after their kind. This is an obvious purpose of the seed. You get more plants, and you get the same kind of plants. There's another purpose to the seed that I want you to think about this morning, though. Because the reality is that plants produce many, many times more seeds than are necessary just to get more plants. I don't know if you've been around this kind of thing much, but it is astounding how many seeds a plant can make. And the production of seed requires a lot of energy from the plant. It takes a good deal of the plant's vitality to produce the seed. So why waste so many? Why produce so many more than is necessary if it doesn't help anything? And the answer is that God designed these plants not just to fill up the earth with vegetation, but to feed the creatures that were going to be created in a couple of days. This is the obvious purpose of such abundance of seed. They are for feeding the creatures that God has yet to make on day three when he makes the plants. Now, how many tons of wheat can come from a wheat field? It's staggering. If you have a wheat field and you have a good year, then you can get a good amount of seed, which is what those little pieces of wheat are. They're seeds. You get a good amount of seed and you set it aside for next year because you're going to want to plant this field again. And then you get all of the seed that you're going to want to grind into flour and make bread with for at least a year so that you've got bread until the next harvest. And then when you've got that set aside and that set aside, you have got all sorts of wheat left. And so you take it and you sell it to someone who does not have a wheat field so that you can buy something besides bread for this year. It's amazing how much stuff can grow up out of the ground, how productive these plants are that God made, and how many people can be fed from a little bit of ground if it's done right. How much of the dirt in America, just our portion of North America, just the United States of America, how much of the dirt is not being used to produce a crop right now? Your front yard, probably most of your backyard, all this land you're driving by on the way to work, hoping that the trees will not be gone when you come home from work this afternoon. You had this happen to you yet? You know, you drive out in the morning, you come back, 20 acres are cleared. When did this happen? It happened today. All of the woods around us in this part of the country, fields everywhere that are not growing anything right now, right? I mean, if you needed to, you could plow your yard and you'd get a lot of food to eat out of your yard. If you wanted to do the work and you lived in a neighborhood that would let you plow in the front yard, then you could do it. There's a lot of unused productivity all around us, isn't there? And yet the United States of America can grow enough food to feed the world just using what we're using now. Just what we're using now. If we used more, we could make the world fat, man. And this is a fallen world. This is a world that's been affected by sin in such a way that God cursed the ground on account of Adam and said, by the toil of your brow you'll cultivate it. And this is how productive it is now. Several years ago, I was in South Georgia during the peanut harvest. There was a young man there who my fishing buddy knew pretty well, who had his first plot of land. He had grown up on a farm, and he was out of high school now, and he bought a plot of land and got his peanut permit, which you have to have or they'll put you in jail for growing them. And he planted this field with peanuts, and we drove by on the way back from fishing or on the way to go fishing again or whatever we were doing and stopped. And they have these carts that they'll haul the stuff out of the fields to the road and then put them on the trucks and take them to the market. And he had them all lined up, and they were standing there, so we stopped to talk and looked. And it blew my mind. This sandy soil that didn't look like it'd grow anything, and he had tons of peanuts. Cart after cart after cart. Some had already gone to the market. Out of this dirt. You looked at the plants. You didn't think they were doing anything. The peanuts were under the ground. You couldn't tell anything from looking at the plants. Dried up, pitiful looking things. But he had a bumper crop. What a productive earth this is. And God has made it so in order to feed you. So that you can eat. And even if you don't want to eat your vegetables, what you're eating ate them. So, but think about the amount of your diet that is made up of seeds. All of the grains are seeds. So all of your breads and flours, corn, beans, peas, nuts, oats, put here by God for you on the third day so that you won't starve. Now, many of the seeds in the world are housed in fruit, which you can also eat. Incredibly nutritious, power-packed little pieces, prepackaged for your delight and pleasure. Think of how many different kinds of fruit there are. Have you ever walked through the farmer's market? Have you ever gone to the farmer's market in Decatur, where they've got everything, and you're walking along and you look at this stuff and you go, what is that? And then someone who does not speak English comes in front of you and They have treasure from home. They know what to do with that. I don't. There's incredible variety in the fruit that's in this world. All over the world, varied kinds of fruit. Some we get imported here, some we're not accustomed to, but other parts of the world have as a part of their regular diet, and you can find some of that in the farmer's market. But there are two aspects of the fruit that I want you to think about this morning. Two things that I want you to think about that all fruit in the world has in common. Number one, it does not help the parent plant. There is no direct effect, no benefit for the parent plant to bear this fruit. Number two, all of the nutrients that are wrapped up in this fruit, none of that helps the seed to grow. There's no reason for the parent plant to bear fruit for that own plant's sake. It takes a lot of energy. It uses up an incredible amount of the nutrients that that plant can produce. And it does not make the parent plant more healthy or more successful directly in any way. Nor does the seed benefit from all those nutrients. It's not like the seed is in there pulling on those nutrients so it can grow. The energy that the seed needs to grow is in the seed itself. And so the fruit can be gone and the seed still has everything that it needs to sprout and grow. It doesn't pull energy from the fruit as it grows. So the fruit has a purpose that does not relate to the new plant growing, and it does not relate to the parent plant having any direct benefit either. The fruit is here to feed the creatures of the earth. And it's the only good reason to have it. You say, well, it's payment. So the creatures will carry the seed away from the parent plant, right? That's what the evolutionists tell you. The plant developed this technique. Notice that plants can have intelligence, but God can't. The plant developed this technique in order to entice the creatures of the earth to carry the seed to a new location away from the shade of the parent plant, and so that this thing would have a better chance of survival. It's a strategy for survival. And I'm going, well, if it's a strategy just for survival, why not make those little helicopters that the other plants have? Then it can fly there and you don't have to wait on the creature to come by and carry it somewhere. It's for you. God did this for you and for all of the animals to have food. And again, the abundance and variety are amazing. There is much more than is needed just to get new plants. Most of the seed fails to grow because there's much more than you need. It's there for you to eat. The fruit is there for you to eat. It's God's provision for you. Edible fruit with seed inside of it. Seed capable of passing through the digestive system of an animal and still producing a plant of the same kind as the parent plant. Or seed housed in a hard pit that you'll leave alone, throw aside, and every other creature will too, and then the seed can grow up. But God designed this as food for you, for the creatures He was going to put here. And He made the variety for you. He made many of the plants to bear fruit with seed inside of it. Apples. And tomatoes, strawberries, actually have them on the outside. Avocados and mangoes and squash and peppers and melons and grapes and plums and pomegranates and kiwis. Think of the variety, oranges and lemons. But God created it for a purpose, and it was not a strategy for the survival of the plant. Way too much energy if that's why. If that's the only thing, then the plant would do something more efficient than make fruit. It's for you. It's God's abundant provision for you so that you'd have all you need. So on day three, God created life, the first biological life, reproducible, self-sustaining life. And life that produces an abundance of food that does not benefit those plants. but does benefit you. All of this designed by God's perfect wisdom to serve a purpose in the paradise that He was creating, that He was going to put people in on day six. Now, for the discussion time, I want to ask you a question. What if some of our atheistic evolution faith proponents were to produce a life form in the laboratory? What would you think about that?
What do they start with?
What do they start with? All right, it's a valid question. It's like the joke, you know, where the scientist dreamed that he and God were in a contest to make life, and God stopped him at the first step and said, make your own dirt. Well, there is that. What do you think the evolutionist is going to say if they can ever successfully take these building blocks and make it come to life? Chandler?
They have lied so much in the past to try to prove their theory. I would be suspicious of anything they said or anything that it did, figuring there was some sort of, for a better word, hocus pocus.
Well, yeah, certainly there would be reason to question it. But I'm saying if it really did happen, would it derail us? Would it?
Yeah.
Would it give them a valid argument for their position that life just happened?
They'd probably claim the whole theory was true. You know, not just the fact that you can take building blocks and make a one cell something with it, but that, you know, you plant a cabbage and you get an hamster.
Yeah. Yeah, they would. I mean, this is their agenda, so they would say this proves it. Chandler?
They would have no way of proving this because since according to their theory, everything happened over these millions and billions of years, they can say, look what we've done, but there would be no way to disprove it because a million years now it's going to be different, you know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Mark?
I would say that even if it did happen, it would just be a judgment of God to entrench them in their lie. You know, I mean, God's the one who made it happen. It would just be God making it happen in their laboratory.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, almost in a judgment to just make them, as you said, they're just going to, you know, think that they did it. So they're going to interpret that to prove their theories right or their their evolutionist faith, rather. And, you know, just the ultimate outcome of that would be an entrenchment in their own lies and sinful hearts.
Yeah, I think you may be right about that. Chris?
And even if they did create a life form, they're still, like you were talking about before, they've got a model to go by. So they're not really creating a life form. They're just recreating
right. Some
life form.
Right. They didn't invent it. Well, somebody else?
Along Tim's, I don't know who used to say this, but, you know, I've heard that to believe in, you know, evolution is to say that, well, gee, that's a beautiful house. Where did it come from? And your answer is, well, there was this big explosion in a lumberyard. And next thing, you know, and so what the evolutionists would do is say, well, we created a 2x4. So therefore, the 2x4 eventually teaches itself how to build a house.
Right.
You know, put the sheetrock on, the wiring.
Every building has its architect, I guess
you say. So if some scientist were able to create a new organism, a life form, what would it prove? I'm going to stretch it. I know now you may need another cup of coffee, but what would it prove? It would prove that intelligence can create life, wouldn't it? How does this help their theory?
It didn't take billions of years.
You see, even if that happened, it didn't just happen. Someone applied intellect. Someone had to look at God's examples and study it. And if they ever do create life, they're going to say, well, we're proving it now. But all they proved is that intelligence can create, which is what we've been saying all along. An infinite intelligence can make everything you have around you. And with your limited intelligence, Mr. Scientist, if you ever manage to create some small living thing, all you did was prove what God said he did in the beginning. If he proves anything, it proves only that intelligence can be applied to something to generate this. So if it ever does happen, Christians will not need to freak out, and they will not need to become theistic evolutionists, because that wouldn't prove the theory. In fact, it's another disproof of the theory that it could just happen. It can't just happen. Now let me switch gears on you, because we've talked a little bit about the variety here. Why so much variety in the seeds and in the fruit and in the different kinds of plants that God made? Why? The wheat and the watermelon and the grape, and why all this radically different stuff? Why all the different colors, different flavors, different sizes?
Well, the children of Israel got sick of eating manna, so I imagine we get sick of eating bananas.
Yeah, it's a blessing, but it also proclaims God's glory.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, God's glory and our pleasure. The evolutionist is always talking about the strategy of the plant or the strategy of the animal for survival. You think about how much inefficiency there is in this incredible variety and in some of the fruits that grow and some of the production of seed that is so amazing. It's not streamlined. It's not the path of least resistance that you would take in a survival mode. It's to the glory of God. And it's for you. Tell me, on a scale of 1 to 10, how necessary is it for your survival that you even have taste buds? 10 being we couldn't live without them, and go down the scale from there. How necessary are your taste buds to your personal survival? Yeah, it's a zero on a scale of 1 to 10, isn't it? And yet God gave them to you. Now, how different is a watermelon from a banana, from a plum, from a kernel of wheat? How complicated are all these flavors and textures that you can enjoy, but that serve no other purpose but to glorify God and to give you pleasure? Now, when we talked about atheism several months back, we were doing that evangelism study, and we talked about the hardened atheist. Do you remember what his motivation was for saying there is no God? Pop quiz.
Accountability.
Accountability?
Accountability.
Yeah, that's part of it.
You don't want to give God glory.
Yeah, that's part of it. Why not? What does he love? He loves his sin, right? And in this love of sin, and usually it's some particularly vile sins with the atheists, they don't want anybody telling them not to do this thing that they love. They always describe the God that they don't believe in certain terms. They don't believe in him, but they can define him. The one they don't believe in is a tyrant, is a killjoy, is all of those things. You know, he doesn't want me to have any fun, this God you believe in. That's how the atheists approach it. Now, look at Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7. Genesis 2, 7. This is the detailed account of the latter part of creation and the summary account of the rest of creation. And verse 7 picks up with us. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. The Lord God planted a garden toward the east in Eden, and there he placed the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground the Lord God caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So God formed man, put him in this bountiful garden, and caused every tree to grow there for Adam. Is this a picture of a killjoy? This God who gave Adam such incredibly discerning tastes, smells, ability to detect texture with fingertips, with your tongue. This is a God who does not hate pleasure. You don't have to have this to survive. When you're in survival mode, there are times your taste buds don't help, folks. If you were stranded in the woods and you had to eat whatever you could find, your taste buds are working against you at that point. This is a God who loves you, who delights to bless you, and who created a paradise for Adam's enjoyment. This is not a killjoy. This is not a tyrant. All of these plants point to the glory of God. The more we know about them, the more they glorify God. Some of the ways the seeds are dispersed are staggering. There are plants where the husks will dry out until they explode. And when they explode, they'll scatter seed 30 feet or more in every direction. Get them out of the shade where they can grow. It's just amazing, some of the things. Some of the pods will shrink and they fire the seeds out one at a time, like shooting a gun. Some of them float down like helicopters. Some of them float on the wind like a dandelion. All of this variety just to show the wisdom of God and his provision for you. Even in that, it's not just so you can survive. There's pleasure in it. Because of God's love for you, he wants you to enjoy living in his creation. So you don't have to eat quail every day or a banana every day.
Or locust.
Yeah. Mm. And thankfully, we don't have to eat locust every day. Maybe not any day, that'd be all right. That's where those taste buds come in again, you know. In the scripture, we don't have a picture of the God the atheist describes as a tyrant and a killjoy. We have a God who has created all sorts of things that are not necessary for survival at all. It totally contradicts the evolution foolishness. None of this stuff makes sense. From an evolutionist point of view, it is inefficient. It is not for survival. There would be better ways, more streamlined ways, if that's all it were. This is a picture of God whose glory is beyond our imagination, but a glimpse of it we see in creation. And it is a reminder of God's love for us, that even in the tiniest details of life, he has thought about us and chosen to bless us. Now, I mentioned to you that this point of view is illegal in our country. I don't know if you knew this. It can't be taught in public places. It is against the law. Ours is the only religion that's against the law in the United States of America. U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1987 that creationism cannot be taught in public schools, even alongside evolution as another option. And this Thursday, a U.S. District Court judge in Atlanta, Georgia, ordered Cobb County to remove those stickers out of the textbooks. Remember all the stir about that a few weeks ago? As predicted, the judge said that this violates the, quote, constitutional ban on the separation of church and state. Now, it doesn't matter that that is not in the Constitution. Nobody's read it. Nobody questions that anymore. I want you to hear, though, what the sticker said. This is what's illegal. This is what a U.S. district judge ruled this week is wrong and is against the law to print for children educated with your tax dollars in the United States of America. This is what the sticker said in the science books in Cobb County. This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origins of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. End quote. It is illegal not only to teach creation now, it is illegal to say when you're faced with evolution, you should keep an open mind. That's what the sticker says. It doesn't mention creation. It doesn't mention religion. But so fanatical in their fascism are the proponents of this religion that a judge will boldface say it violates a ban that's not in the Constitution of separation of church and state, a concept that's not mentioned. It violates that to say, keep an open mind when you read this. This is not necessarily proven. We're in a battle, folks. It's a spiritual battle. The people on the other side of the aisle, or the battlefield, or whatever, don't play fair because this is their religion. And they're as fanatical as any religious group has ever been. They will say anything, do anything, lie any lie to have their way. They will not have anybody even question their view, let alone proclaim the truth. Now, I read that to you because the challenge before us is getting more and more every day, like what Peter had to say in Jerusalem that day. Choose for yourselves whether it's right to obey God or to obey you. As for us, we cannot stop speaking these things. Let me lead us in prayer.